Welcome to Juno Afternoon. It's November 3rd. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Back after a long break. Good to be back. A piano series that explores Listomania and Rachmaninoff. That's going to be an evening of exploration and beautiful piano music. We'll find out all about it. Then painting at the end of the Ice Age with David Rosenthal, who's been painting glaciers for nearly 50 years and has seen a lot of change. You can see a special exhibit of his work at the State Museum. We'll talk to him. And a new childcare apprentice program in Juneau is looking for people with a passion for working with young children and families. We'll find out about this two-year program, plus a sneak preview of the last episode of the KTO podcast, Maga Cuento. That's all ahead today. I hope you'll join me for the weather. Rain is likely tonight, but then it should be partly sunny skies tomorrow with increasing clouds and a chance for showers starting on Sunday. And then rain is predicted heading into next week, but it looks like we've got one day of a nice break tomorrow.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akhwan. The Kliné Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk a eat in. Jin katka ke jin talk an akhaya ha ani kak gunish cheese.
Bend it, not let it go. From a mess to the masses.
Well, that's good lead-in music for a piano series. Wait a minute. Why is that good music for a piano series? Well, that's a French band, Phoenix, doing Listomania, and we're going to find out all about Liszt, or we're going to go on a musical journey about Liszt, and we're talking to John Hayes, who's here with us. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
John's here. Part of a really interesting concert coming up called the Juno Piano Series. It's going to be John playing Years of Pilgrimage, an evening with Liszt. And then also, Meiju is going to be playing a program of Rachmaninoff also with you as well on that accompanying as well. And John, thanks so much for coming in. And tell me a little bit. I played that Listomania. You do just a little bit of research on Liszt and you find out a pretty fascinating guy.
Yeah, for right. Sure.
Sort of called maybe the first rock star is the way I saw some articles talked about. Yeah. So tell me about Liszt.
Well, you know, I mean, he was born in 1811. And died in 1886. So, you know, we're talking almost two centuries ago, but he is sort of the original rock star, the big persona, the performer that is.
The Sinatra, the Elvis.
Virtuoso of right. The instrument and all of that.
And but also generated all that excitement as
yes.
Well, not just
right.
a great virtuoso, but also.
But like before Liszt, there were not commonly solo piano recitals.
In fact, I heard that he termed the term recital was something that
itself,
Liszt came up
right.
with. Yeah.
Because, I mean, literally it means to speak.
Uh-huh.
So it's piano. We're not speaking.
Right.
But you are speaking when you play the instrument
right.
like that.
We do have a short clip, and then we'll talk a little bit about what Meiju is going to be playing too with Rachmaninoff. But we have a short clip of your playing of some of Liszt here. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think we're going to hear here? We grabbed a clip and we'll listen to it here.
Right. So what I recorded just yesterday is the first piece in the Years of Pilgrimage. So it's the Chapel of William Tell. So this is an actual physical location on a lake where the titular William Tell, who was, you know, the revolutionary figure, he was captured by the state and they were riding on a boat and he had occasion to escape in the midst of a storm and jump off of the boat and all that. But this is the end of that piece. And it's a chapel, so it's very majestic. It's arrived. It's victorious. And then it transitions into the next piece in the Years of Pilgrimage, which is On the Lake Wallenstadt. So it's the very image of a placid and calm lake scene.
So these are pieces, piano pieces, that definitely have a strong narrative to them. They're about telling a story.
Yes.
Or multiple stories.
And a lot
stories.
Of water.
Yes.
Tree.
Okay. Well, we'll listen to it. This is John Hayes playing a piece, just a small snippet here of Years of Pilgrimage and Evening of Liszt. And we'll talk to John a little bit more about it after we listen to this. I can definitely see that transition you're talking about there, going from that dramatic moment to, as you said, rowing maybe on a lake is sort of
yeah.
No, it's really fascinating. So this Years of Pilgrimage, tell me a little bit about that piece.
So it is a series of nine pieces that Franz Liszt wrote. Composed off and on over the next decade, but
he wrote for many, many decades, right? He had a long career of writing and performing.
They're based on his time in Switzerland around 1835. This set of pieces wasn't published until about 1845, I think, but many of them existed in earlier forms or whatnot. But Switzerland, 1835, he would have been 23, going on to 24. He had just left Paris with the woman he was having an affair with, Marie Dajot. So they went to Switzerland and they lived there for almost 2 years, I think. And they'd traveled all around that country and saw different things, you know, famous for its lakes and mountains. And it's not all Switzerland-centric. Some of it is just about the broader literature that Liszt would have been reading at that time. Things by Byron or Goethe, Schiller, all the great early romantic authors. But it really is... it comes across as like an album in the literal sense, where it's like
a concept album.
These things go together.
Yeah. Right.
They're not necessarily super obvious, but.
Yeah. Huh. And you mentioned romantic novelists. Is Liszt what is he in a sort of category? Is he considered in a category of composers or of musical trends?
Romantic,
yeah.
Which music was, for some reason, a few decades after the literature romantic era. You know, Goethe was like 1790. Liszt, you know, born 1811.
Right.
So there's a bit of a gap there, but obviously this literature had a huge impact on all the arts.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what Meiju is going to be performing as well. She's got a program of Rachmaninoff.
Yes. So Meiju is, we decided that at first I was going to have her do a full recital by herself. But then we realized that together we would be able to do a full program of Rachmaninoff. And this is the 150th anniversary of his birth year. So it was timely, whereas like she has these pieces she can play and I can have the other half and we can combine the powers. So she will be playing three early works by Rachmaninoff from the Opus 3, which includes an elegy, a prelude, and a melody in title. The prelude is very famous, infamously so, because Rachmaninoff once sold the rights to that composition. He sold it to a publisher, but he didn't get any royalties from it. But the piece was like wildly popular. If he had gotten royalties, like he would have been set for life, probably. And people would like at concerts say like, play it, play it. And he came to sort of hate that piece, but
because he got nothing from it.
So this is Opus 3. He was probably like 18 when he wrote that. And then together, May and I will be doing 8 different preludes from his Opus 23, which would have been composed, I think, about 12 years later. And then 2 forehand pieces. So same piano, 2 pianists.
Oh, okay.
Combine the hands together.
So that's always fascinating to see how that all works. And just seems like the stakes are high, right?
Yeah.
We're both on there. Well, we have a little bit. Do you know which one we're going to listen to?
Yeah,
here?
Yeah, so this is from the later set of preludes. This is in D major, number 4.
Okay, this is Meiju doing some Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff, and that's Meiju playing that. We were just talking some of this, though. You're going to be playing on the same keyboard two people at once, so Is that harder, or is that, or tell me about how the dynamic of that.
It is comparable in difficulty, but you have to be more responsible because the other person relies on you.
Right. You can't just go off tempo for a minute and then catch back.
Yeah, alone, you can make a mistake and chances are the audience might not know. But forehands, your partner is going to know.
Become a horrible tangle all of a sudden. Yeah. Well, that sounds fascinating and a really fun part of, I'm sure it's a fun part of performing though too, right? To be able to do that. It must be.
Well, piano is sort of infamous for like, we do so much alone in a practice room. And then we suddenly encounter other people and have to like do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very different from the choir or band experience or orchestra experience where like you're a kid and you've always done music as a group.
Sure.
And it's the introvert having to go in and learn like the other skills.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we should talk a little bit about when this is. It's tomorrow night, right? At 7 p.m.
Yes. I have my tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Jack. And then Meishu and I are November 12th, 3 p.m. And general admission is $25, senior $20, student $10. Everything is an extra $5 at the door.
Okay.
So
good incentive to think ahead of time there.
Go to the Jack box office website and buy that. Tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. So tonight for tomorrow's show.
For mine. Yes, you have time for May's.
Yeah. And May's and John as well is happening on November 12th. And that's 3 p.m. And that's at the Jack at 3 p.m. But tomorrow night at 7 p.m. is the one for the Years of Pilgrimage and Evening of List. Why did you decide on List for this time around?
I've had some of these pieces floating around over the years. And like I said, it just is a complete recital in itself. You know, it's an album. So a little less thinking on my part. And then I have to actually study the pieces and think about the literary influences and everything. But
when he put this together, though, is it hour and a half kind of total playing time or?
50 minutes,
and then
I'm playing one Hungarian Rhapsody by Liszt, which is the more like virtuosic, brilliant showman type of music.
And what was it about Liszt that elicited all the excitement from what you've read and from your studies?
Well, I mean, he came around at a time that there was a greater culture of like the salon music. Like in Paris, primarily, even, you know, you would have people in their homes giving concerts and inviting like everyone they knew. And piano fits easily in spaces. And it's also the beginning of an era when the piano before Liszt was a very different instrument than we.
I was going to ask what the evolution of the actual instrument.
It was a little bit. It was made entirely of like wood and not metal, you know. So it was like
it
a smaller,
as resonant,
not and, as powerful an instrument.
Right.
But then, by the time you get to Liszt, it's starting to become much more like the modern instrument, and he really had phenomenal ability as a performer. The pieces I'm playing are not even near as difficult as many of the things he wrote. And he came from a tradition of, you know, great piano players, but then he transformed it throughout his entire life so that it was meeting what the piano is capable of and then transforming it even further to be the foundation of modern piano playing.
Was there a flamboyance to the way he played, that sort of thing, or was it more just the recognition of great skill?
Both, I think, in a way. I think he probably could throw the arms around and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But he was also a little bit priestly in his mannerisms, I think. You know, I mean, I think he would dress in like long, just like sheer black clothing and be very like this. This
pious almost or
image appearing,
right,
playing music. And like he actually became a I don't know the exact details, but some sort of like priestly level in the Catholic Church later in his life. So he has this like dichotomy.
After he left his wild times behind there.
He has this dichotomy of like diabolic and holy,
right,
like meeting together.
Oh, fascinating. Well, it's the Years of Pilgrimage. That's an evening of Liszt. And John Hayes, who we've been talking to, is going to be performing that tomorrow night over at the Jack at 7 p.m. The general admission is $25 at the door. But if you order early at jahc.org, it's only $20. And is that right? Do I have that right? Or it's $25 general admission, but $5 more at the door.
So it'd be $30
total.
Door.
Yeah, that's it. So you'll save $5 if you order tonight or tomorrow. jahc.org is the place to go. John, thanks so much for talking to us. And just a preview as well that the piano series will continue with Mei Zhu on November 12th performing Rachmaninoff. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about that as that gets closer. John, thanks so much for talking to us today. And sounds like a fascinating and fun concert.
Yeah, thanks
all right,
so much.
Thank you. Painting at the End of the Ice Age with David Rosenthal. That's the subject of what's going to be happening at the Alaska Libraries and Museum and Libraries happening just starting today. And so Jackie Manning is with us right now, as well as David Rosenthal, the artist in question, the artist at hand. Hello to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. We were just kind of talking as you were walking in, David, about the changes you must have seen in the nearly 50 years that you've been painting glaciers. First, what was the thing that drew you to painting glaciers in the first place?
Well, I actually came up to Cordova, which is where I still live, in 1977. And I came from Maine, and I had never seen an actual glacier, but I had heard about them when I was growing up because my parents and other adults would point out the rocks in the field and say, the glaciers left those. But there weren't any glaciers anymore. But I got a job in a cannery in Cordova, and I arrived there, and it turns out we got glaciers in Cordova.
Yeah.
And back then, it was even more. But I had already started to paint by the time I arrived in Cordova, and landscape was my interest. And, of course, the glaciers just make such interesting landscapes, and the ice itself is just an endless challenge to paint, and it's fascinating. After all these years, I'm still fascinated by it. So that's what got me started.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you were painting, but you didn't sort of go to painting full time right away, right? You had a whole other series of careers, or at least a career as a physicist. Is that right?
Well, see, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people, when I talk about this, a lot of people mistake the idea that I was studying physics and I didn't get very far. I flunked out of college because I didn't study. And, but then I tried other things, but right around that same time, I was about 19 or so, I started to just draw for the fun of it. And my subject was nature, just because I always loved nature, and especially cold nature. I like the winters in Maine much more than the summers. So when I came up to Cordova and saw this scenery, that's what kind of hooked me into staying. And it also started a pattern because obviously I came out of college with this weird degree combining art and science and not really good for anything. So I took I had worked at this job for, you know, quite a while. And I realized that that's a great way to see the world is take jobs in different places. And so after the cannery, I went out to Bristol Bay to fish and tender. Then I got jobs in Antarctica. I spent 5 years during the 90s on the ice, and then some jobs in Greenland with the same contract people that I had worked with in Antarctica and so on. And it is just a great way to see the world. And at the same time, it wasn't until I started going to Antarctica when I was probably 35 or so that I actually could say that I could make a living as an artist. But I still kept working because it's, you know, took me to these incredible places. And I still do that occasionally. Now I'm not quite as much into traveling and I'm not quite as much into work. I like to paint. So
when you took these different jobs, and I mean, we should just say that the kind of the title of your whole exhibit, Painting at the Edge, at the End of the Ice Age, The Science of Climate Change from Pole to Pole in 40 Years of Paintings. Did these jobs, were you zeroing in on glaciers? Because it sounds like you really hit like the high points of the places to go to see this sort of landscape.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, now with hindsight, I look back and, you know, as I describe it is my real strength has been that I've had all these failures, which have pushed me in these directions. And so, I mean, right from the beginning, I was an artist in Maine when I graduated, but I couldn't find a job and I couldn't get galleries interested in my work. So I took a job in Cordova, just figuring I'd work there for one season and then ended up staying. And then these other jobs came along, like the cannery. I was doing really well there, too well. I might have been still working at the cannery, but it closed down. And so that bumped me into I went fishing and got to see Western Alaska. And then I got to do a lot of artist in the school residencies, which was just a fantastic program for me, to more places all around Alaska. Mm-hmm. And then I'd always had a fascination with Antarctica because it's the big ice and, you know, it's there's no pollen allergies. There's no, you know, all the things that I like are there and none of the things I don't like, bugs and so on. But at any rate, through somebody I worked with at the cannery, I got a job in Antarctica because they got a job. And then I called them up and said, you know, how do you do it? And then those same people that I worked with there, I got jobs in Greenland and other places through, and as well as fishing, and working on a charter boat out of Cordova, as well as chartering it, depending on the situation. And so it's just a lot of little path changes that, you know, it wasn't really conscious, but I guess it was in some ways. It was meant to be.
Yeah. And you had this sort of this one consistent line throughout was this artwork that you were doing throughout. Yeah. Interpreting what you were seeing, landscape artwork, as you were saying. Jackie, how did the museum come to want to do this with David?
Well, David had a solo show back in 2012, 2013 at the Alaska State Museum, right, not too long after I started. And so I had met him then and I had seen his work back in the old museum. And then I actually heard from the a museum in Cordova that had this show up, and David's show painting at the end of the Ice Age is traveling around Alaska. So it's going to be here in Juneau, and then it's going on to Fairbanks and the Anchorage Museum. And so they sent me information about it, and timing with what he's touching on just seemed like a really appropriate show for the museum right now.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's quite an honor, David, I would say. It's amazing to be able to have a solo show of your work in the Alaska State Museum. Yeah,
it is. And it's a wonderful new space. I was amazed. And Jackie's been great to work with. And the show looks great. And it's worked out. And plus, you know, she was able to get me more time for it to show, because this show was never planned. It just, about 5 years ago, I realized, wait a second, you've been observing these glaciers retreating for 40 plus years, you know, there's a show there. I mean, and of course, global warming has been coming. I mean, it's all you hear about now.
The places that you mentioned, Greenland, Antarctica, our state here of Alaska, front lines of global warming, really.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I can see where you're saying that is a story right there to be told.
Yeah.
Like you've been documenting that without even maybe realizing it when you first did it.
Yeah, without realizing. I mean, I just painted these landscapes because they're beautiful, and that's what my interest was. And I don't know why I started painting, but it's something to do with being able to interact with these beautiful environments and landscapes and say something about them. But at any rate, all of a sudden, now I have a purpose. It's wonderful, you know.
And what is this? What's sort of the focus of your talk itself?
The talk is going to be about the show. It's going to be about kind of the background, because I find it's interesting. So I'm going to subject people to the same idea.
Sure.
That of how this developed from me, because everything, like my failed physics experiment, you might say, that is what taught me to paint. The physics I did learn is how I taught myself to paint, because it's all about light and, you know, optics and color, and it's all, and just looking at the world in a rational way and figuring it out is what allows me to paint it. And so I'm going to be talking about this kind of just this way that all these things happened and brought me to the point where here I'm an artist, but all of a sudden I'm doing a show on climate change. And originally the show started out much smaller. I'd showed it in Valdez, and it was just my paintings with 8 information panels to give some context to the, you know, where I was when I painted. And then it's grown every time. Like I showed it in Cordova, and then at the Pratt Museum in Homer. And now this is the biggest version of it. And it's got, I made the addition of, I had worked with all these jobs like in Antarctica and Greenland and some in Alaska with scientists, because they get to go to the coolest places. And so I have friends who are scientists, and I invited some of them to add science panels and information. And so the way I look at this show is that it uses my paintings to, number one, attract an audience that might not be interested in a science exhibit. I also use them as the best possible illustration of some of these, like I've painted series of the some of our local glaciers and some others too, and other places that how they retreat from time to time. Like the Mendenhall Glacier, I especially did for this show. And I have a view of it that I don't usually work from photos. I work from drawings. But in this case, I had Jackie take a picture of Mendenhall Glacier as it is now. And then I painted a version of that for this show. And then I combined that with what I remember when I believe I saw it the first time in the late 70s or the early 80s. And it's a dramatic difference.
Mm-hmm.
And So my work makes really good illustrations, and I think you'll see that when you look at the show.
What media do you work in? Are you acrylic? Are you oil?
This is oils. Oil. Uh-huh. I'm mainly an oil painter, but I use watercolors for studies, and I teach watercolor. But then on top of the paintings, this exhibit has what I call narrative panels, where I talk about, here's this glacier in Cordova. When I first got there, we used to go out and watch it calve into the Copper River. Now you go there and it barely reaches the Copper River. And I just describe in these narrative panels kind of my story and relating to my subjects over the years. And so that gives, that hopefully will attract people's attention. They'll read that and then look at the changes and the work. And then, of course, this addition of the science, so I can have some real credibility on the science of what's going on. And so I think it's a really good educational tool. And I'm really happy to be doing it because, as I say, I've been telling people all my career I was painting pretty pictures, which is great, except for, is that really... is that really responsible that I spent my life making pretty pictures? Well,
there's a larger story going on.
Yeah,
and
now.
Maybe if you were doing pictures of something else, it wouldn't be an imperative to tell a larger
story.
That's exactly right.
I feel like now, wow, this is great. I'm actually able to contribute something back.
Right. And so the talk you're going to be doing is tonight at 6:30, and that's happening at the State Museum. And then you're also tomorrow going to be doing a youth art activity, right? Is that happening as well?
Yes, yeah. And I believe it's all full. He's doing two watercolor workshops, and they filled up.
Good to know that that's happening as well. Yes. Yeah, that's very cool. And this exhibit is running all the way through to March, right?
Yes.
So you have an opportunity to see it, but it'd be great to go out and see it tonight or weekend. But
the opening is 4:30 to 6:30. So if people want to come, they can actually talk to me and ask questions.
Yeah, that's terrific. Great. That's a great offer. And Jackie, I know this is also part of a series.
Yes. So with this exhibit, and also we have Alaska Positive opening next month, we've put together a lecture series called Cooler Seasons, Warming World, and it is our fall-winter speaker series from the Alaska State Museums, so Alaska State Museum here in Juneau and the Sheldon Jackson Museum. So we have David's talk tonight, and then on November 9th, Sabina Allen will be discussing the meaning of traditional ecological knowledge and stereotypes about Indigenous people as environmentalists. And that will be in Sitka and also via Zoom. And then November 17th, we have the Alaska Positive juror Camille Seaman flying to Juneau from Denmark. And she will be giving a talk about her career as a photographer. And she's been to many of the same places as David. She's photographed both Antarctica, Greenland, Alaska. She's been here many times. And she, too, has experienced climate change over her career. And then on March 1st, we have Ben Huff, who will be giving a talk about his photography series, The Light That Got Lost, and his work with the Juneau Icefield Research Program, which is the longest running glacier research program in North America. So
really cool stuff. That's great. All happening at the Alaska State Museum. Such a great resource for us here in Juneau and for the whole state. Well, it's Painting at the End of the Ice Age. That's happening. The show is starting tonight at 4:30, and then a talk is happening tonight at 6:30 with David Rosenthal, who we've been speaking with today. David, so good to meet you. Thanks for coming
nice
to town
you,
and for
man.
Bringing your beautiful artwork with you and for providing this opportunity for people to talk to you and to hear about your experiences. And Jackie, thanks so much for coming as well.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
Thanks to both of you.
Well, today marks the launch of the final episode of the KTOO News podcast, Magua Cuento, and it's going to be episode 5, and it's titled Recreating Cultural Spaces in Juneau's Filipino Community. And right now, we've got a little preview of that. Here's Magua Cuento, and KTOO's own news staff put this together, and we'll let you know a little bit more about it when we hear this clip.
A quiet hush fell over a sold-out auditorium at Juno Douglas High School. It's a Saturday evening back in 2005. Dancers filed onto the stage with a light tinkling sound from the beads on their colorful costumes. Kay Roldan was one of them.
This was the first showcase of its kind. This is the first time we've even really learned about our folk dance and music and costume, and it was a big production.
As the lights came up, the drums started beating.
It really did bring our Filipino community together, like kind of like a calling, like let's share our culture and showcase what people don't know about us.
This is Manga Cuento, a podcast about the diverse stories of Juno's Filipino community. I'm your host, Tasha Elizarde. In its heyday, the Ali Tap Tap folkloric dance group was a spectacle of Filipino culture, both in Juno and across Alaska. Filipinos, from elementary schoolers to elders, learned and shared the story of Filipino history through dance. But it's been more than a decade since those dancers took the stage, and kids who once danced under the careful instruction of their elders are adults now. Without Ali Tap Tap, they're left searching for spaces to connect and pass down Filipino culture. KTOO's Anna Canny has the story.
That's going to be episode 5 of Manga Cuento podcast. It's going to be able to catch all those episodes of the KTO News Project in your podcast app of choice, or you can go online at kto.org/Manga Cuento. That's MGAKUWENTO. Or you can hit the banner on the KTO homepage. That's the easiest place to find it. Go to the KTO homepage. Also, a reminder that there is an exhibit at the Juno Douglas City Museum entitled Manga Cuento, Filipinos in Juno, which will run until November 22nd. For more on the museum exhibit, you can go to juno.org/museum. Reminder that the admission to the City Museum is free this entire month, courtesy of the Friends of the Juno Douglas Museum. The Manga Cuento project was led by community engagement producer for KTOO, Tasha Elizarde, who you just heard. Congrats to her and the entire news team on this great project. That's Manga Cuento. The last episode is airing today, but you can binge listen to all the episodes by just going to kto.org and clicking on the banner that says Manga Cuento. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Andy Klein. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about an introductory way to get into something that might be a passion of yours. And if it is, this is a perfect opportunity to take advantage of it. The AEYC SEA New Apprenticeship Program. Tess Olympia, Child Care Apprentice Coordinator, and Blue Scheibler are here to tell us about it. It's a 2-year program that you're introducing, or maybe has already been introduced. Tell me a little bit more about it. People who are maybe interested in getting into childcare, this is a great entree into becoming a professional in that field.
Yeah, so the Child Care Apprentice Program is perfect for people who aren't already in childcare but are interested in working with young children and families and looking for a career pathway. So through the apprenticeship program, people will become students and attend classes at UAA, and this is for people here in Juno, and some of those classes are in person at UAS as well. And while attending classes, apprentices will get paid for on-the-job training while they are placed in childcare centers around town. And so through the training and through the courses, they'll complete 2,000 hours of work experience and earn an occupational endorsement in infant and toddler development.
Wow. So it sounds like it's really hands-on. It's kind of, this program is really meant to be something that you get right in it.
Yeah. The on-the-job training piece is really essential to gaining the skills needed to become an early child care provider.
Yeah. Tell me about how you can see this working for someone that's getting interested in this field, Blue.
Well, I think often people get into childcare jobs with no previous education or experience in the field. And then some people just have a really natural talent for it and they are really successful and love it and stay with it. And other people might love it, but they feel a little bit unprepared going into it because they don't have that foundational education or experience. So this is a way for people to sort of have a slow entry into all the experiences of taking care of children while also learning the essential skill and foundational knowledge of child development.
Yeah, so just like any successful training program, you go equipped with the tools, you know? I mean, I think that people can, I'm sure that people have the experience of feeling overwhelmed in any profession, and this is one of them, if they just don't feel like they have the right tools when they're being asked to, you know, provide the service.
Exactly. And statewide, we're looking at a real shortage in a skilled workforce in childcare and early education. That's a big part of why there's a supply shortage. So this program aims to kind of address that problem, too, just putting more people into the sector.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of can't talk childcare without talking about like this critical need that we hear about all the time, hear from friends and family, but also hear about on the news about shortage of services, about people trying to find childcare and just can't find it, the expense of it, all that. So how does this program work into helping to solve that issue?
Well, one of the ways that we're hoping to do that is by working with the Department of Labor to get our program to be a registered apprentice program, because that will help build the supports for it to be a true career pathway with livable wages on the outside, on the outcome of it. Mm-hmm. Right now, the pay will be $20 per hour for apprentices to work and attend school. So you get paid to go to school at the same time. And there's wage increases throughout. And that's part of being a registered apprenticeship program, is that you're building that capacity for a higher wage. And right now, childcare wages are still below the city average. And so by partnering with the Department of Labor, we're hoping to gain more funding to increase wages for all childcare providers.
Yeah, it has just seemed like an intractable issue. You know, on the one hand, people who are needing childcare can only pay a certain amount. On the other hand, you have to have a livable wage. You have to have a good wage. You want to have very qualified people working with children, and you want that to be a positive experience for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's often talked about as a failed business model for that reason. You can't charge enough to cover your operating expenses as a business. But I have to say, in Juneau, that's just not the case anymore. We administer operating grants for childcare providers specifically to pay higher wages. So starting wages for childcare providers in Juneau is closer to $20 an hour now, a lot higher than the average in the rest of the state. And that's really thanks to support from the city.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a city grant.
So it's another one of the, this is a program, part of it sort of looking up, this sort of maybe turning the corner on getting childcare to be more affordable for people to get, but also more of a career track for people, which sounds like this what this program is all about.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it will be at no cost to participants as well. So we're trying to cover as much as we possibly can. So tuition is paid for in full as well.
How many people are you hoping to recruit for this?
We are hoping to get 5 apprentices, and people can apply online right now by going to the aeyc-sea.org and find the link there, or they can email me there's a flyer on the website.
Yeah, I went to the link you guys provided, the link, and you know, right away you get into a little questionnaire that sort of, you know, just asks some very basic questions about what you're looking to do. And, you know, the time commitment is put out there. It's a 2-year program, so it's all made very clear. So it seems like it's almost like an AA degree or something in a way, right? Like, that kind of a idea.
Yeah, the degree is definitely stackable. So the CDA can move into the occupational endorsement for infant and toddler learning, which can also move into the AA. And then that can move up to be a BA for a bachelor's degree for somebody eventually.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about how that sort of progresses.
So the credits themselves can be transferred into those degrees. And right now, UAA is one of our partners working with us. And so if somebody does come in with experience and has a CDA, those credits can be transferred for free into the OEC. And so that will reduce the amount of classes and duplication that somebody would need.
And UAA, they provide this degree at a fuller, you know, the 4-year degree, or how does that work, or where's is there an institution in the state that provides that?
Great question.
Within the University of Alaska system, the regional campuses try not to duplicate. So right now, UAA has the School of Early Education, and in Fairbanks, they also have an early childhood program, but I think it's focused on family studies.
So this is administered by UAA, but is a Juno program.
Yeah, right. It's administered by UAA. They have the occupational endorsement piece and the AA and BA. And in Juno, AUIC helps sponsor an adjunct professor to teach UAA classes as part of the occupational endorsement certificate, one class per semester in person at UAS. And that's been going on for almost 2 years now. We've got a group of 7 childcare providers here who have been taking those courses, toward this.
If someone's listening right now and they haven't necessarily thought about this as a career track, what are some of the things that you might tell a person? You know, but think about this, this, and this, you might actually be really well suited for this.
Well, I think the field is, it's a really big field. It's really vast. There's a lot of things you can do with early childhood and working with infants and toddlers. One of my favorite pieces is learning about, in my education, was learning about the brain and brain development at all the stages of ages as they move along. There's so many exciting things in there. And early childhood is very different than elementary school and beyond, but it's also the most rewarding because you are getting to play with babies and watching their faces just like glow and brighten up and all of those pieces that are there.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating piece of it, isn't it? You're talking about, really you're thinking about psychology, brain development, all these different things. And then working with different abilities and different children, and different children have different aptitudes, and all that kind of stuff is happening as well.
Yeah.
It happens even at an incredibly early age.
Yeah. And the language acquisition is another one of my big favorite parts of just watching a child learn to speak and then using that language to get what they need and what they want. And then just to say things that they want to say.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating.
I think another interesting part about this career is that really just starts with an interest. That's all you need to get started. Everything else really can be learned through on the job training and then some classes. You just have to be interested in it.
Yeah. And what a perfect opportunity to do that. You know, sign up for this course, actually get reimbursed for your time spent during it, and then work your way towards this certification. It's the new apprenticeship program. It's the AEYC. Sorry, it's a little bit of a tongue twister.
It's a long one.
AEYC SEA New Apprenticeship Program. You can go to AEYC-SEA.org and you can find out more information about this, and you can actually go ahead and fill out the application program little questionnaire on there, and it'll get you going on your way. It sounds like a fascinating step and a fascinating way to start a journey of a whole career track that really can be rewarding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks to both Tess Olympia and Blue Scheibler for coming in and talking to us about this. And good luck with getting great recruits here in Southeast Alaska for early childhood, for the new apprenticeship program that you're doing for childhood education.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for Juno Afternoon, broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at kto.org, and rebroadcast on this station at 7 p.m. For more on the show, or to listen to past shows, or to just find out more about KTOO, you can go to kto.org/JunoAfternoon. Boston Christopher is our producer. We had help today from Aaron Tripp. Theme music is by Indian Agent, and I'm Andy Klein. glad to be back as your host for today. Until next time, have a great afternoon.